In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The Word was God. The Word was God. The Word was God. 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 Was Was God. Was God. Was God. Was God. Was God. Was God. Was God.
Was God. Language.
Was God. Was
Good evening, everybody. This is DJ Sam, and you're listening to A Quick One Before the Eternal Worm Devours Medford on 91.5 FM, WMFO Medford, Tufts Freeform Radio. Yeah, we're returning back after a long absence. I think it's been like 6 months now. But the Eternal Worm has come back to devour Medford. And there's a host of other terrors that are coming from Medford as well. And I'm going to be reading about them with some ambient backing. But first, let's get a little history lesson. Whoever lives, so shall they die, and may they die a drowning death, with all of life inside their mouths, and naught but stones inside their lungs, like David with the skull, dwelling upon it at every second, the impossible trials of seizing, stopping, ending. When a historian looks back, what he sees is death. It is everywhere the universal constant informing everything. Only the historian is aware of how we are blind to the amount of history pushing into our backs, blind to time and our place in it. We are ignorant of history and ignorant of death, and only the historian sees it for what it is. Antiochus was, in this sense, nothing if not a historian. As he says in the messages, when we become known to death, and death known to us, we react as if we are the first, as if we were Adam in the garden, death, a great injustice, a surprise. But this death matters very little. Who are we to shed a single tear over one more dead soul when it is simply another in the unceasing parade of death down our streets, in our fields, in our homes? Why are we surprised when we join its dancing flow? That passage sounds harsh to modern ears, but it perfectly describes the paradoxes of the historian's strait. As an example, the years 1348 to 1350 were not good ones for humankind. A wave of infectious diseases, varied but overshadowed by the bubonic plague, swept across the globe, killing indiscriminately. Typhus, influenza, and smallpox were all prevalent. In just 2 years, the population of Europe was cut by a quarter. The town of Toulouse was home to 30,000 souls in 1335, and only 8,000 a century later. 1,400 people died in just 3 days in Avignon, the seat of the papacy. There was officially nowhere to hide. Not a single one of those dead men, women, children, fathers, mothers, lovers, or friends knew that their death was simply one part of the greatest culling of the human race ever known. A simple mark in the ones column for the greatest disaster in history. Death has a belt, and he notches it just once, no matter who you are. Not one of those people appreciated the big picture, the great number, over the extinguishing of their lives, their life, their loves, their woes, and memories, and happinesses. Not one of them saw it for what it was. They only saw the sores on their limbs, the milky white in their eyes, the blood in their spit and urine. Knowing that an individual death is meaningless, any individual death, especially your own, that you are not a person, but a statistic. Noticing, more each day the countless deaths that occur around you, of other people, of animals, of insects, of the sick and infirm, of accident victims, of plants ripped from the earth and worms crushed beneath the blades of plows, of authors in their rooms scribbling out desperate words in the backs of books no one will ever read, even the shattering of molecular bonds, the disintegration of atomic structures, happening in every moment, millions in each nanosecond, everywhere. This is death consciousness, and it begs the question, what is the point? On an obscure text, ever since they were introduced to the Western world, the books of terror and love have held a certain type of in-person and fascination. They served as inspiration for poetry, music, even a film. Ill-conceived and unsuccessful, The Devil Sings Softly, 1954, now almost impossible to find. They've been the subject of several books and innumerable senior theses. None less than Aleister Crowley makes an allusion to Antiochianism in his Book of Lies, Chapter 29. The abyss of hallucinations has law and reason, but in truth, there is no bond between the toys of the gods. This reason and law is the bond of the great lie. Truth, 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 crieth the Lord of the Abyss of Hallucinations. Death is truth, and truth is death. Why, then, does knowledge of Antiochus and the sect he founded remain almost entirely within the academic realm? In other words, why does practically nobody know who he is? There are multiple reasons. The narrative presented in the books, ending with Antiochus burnt at the stake, and awakening to find himself in a grim, frozen afterlife, is hardly an uplifting. The texts themselves are maddeningly incomplete, and the parts we do possess are often ambiguous and difficult to decipher. Then there is the mystery of the author himself. Is his name a reference to the biblical city of Antioch, or to Antiochus IV, who forced the Jews to make additions to the Old Testament that made it seem as if there was no heaven beyond earth? Did Antiochus even exist? If he did exist, why is historical mention of him so rare, especially considering the size of the cult that sprang up around him? Then, of course, there is the message of the text, perhaps the deepest mystery of all, alternatively one of a seemingly infinite universal nihilism, and of a just existence containing both this world and the next, with the invisible grinding of the gears of law shuddering away just below the surface of our lives. The modern mind finds itself both attracted and repelled by Antiochus' unintelligible worlds, perhaps more so because the incompleteness of what we see today allows us to project our own hopes and fears onto his teachings. That which is incomplete can help it seem modern. screamingly sentient, dumbly delirious, only the gods that work can tell. A sickened, sensitive shadow writhing in hands that are not hands, and whirled blindly past ghastly midnights of rotting creation. Corpses of dead worlds with swords that were cities, charnel winds that brush the pallid stars and make them flicker low. Beyond the world's vague ghosts of monstrous things, half-seen columns, unsanctified temples that rest on nameless rocks beneath space and reach up to dizzy vacua above the spheres of light and darkness. And though this revolting graveyard of the universe, the muffled, maddening beating of drums, and thin, monotonous whine, blasphemous flutes from inconceivable, unlightened chambers beyond time, the detestable pounding and piping whereunto dance slowly, awkwardly, and absurdly the gigantic, tenebrous, ultimate gods.
Thank you.
once the moonbeam spoke to the daemon of the valley, saying, I am old and forget much. Tell me the deeds and aspect and name of them who built these things of stone. And the daemon replied, I am memory, and am wise in the lore of the past. But I too am old. These beings were like the waters of the river Dan, not to be understood. Their deeds I recall not, for they were but of the moment. Their aspect I recall dimly, for it was like that of the little apes in the trees. Their name I recall clearly, for it rhymed with that of the river. These beings of yesterday were called man. So the genie flew back to the thin horned moon, and the daemon looked intently at a little ape in a tree that grew in a crumbling courtyard. Thank you. Fortunato had hurt me 1,000 times, and I had suffered quietly. But then, I learned that he had laughed at my proud name, Montresor, the name of an old and honored family. I promised myself that I would make him pay for this, that I would have revenge. You must not suppose, however, that I spoke of this to anyone. I would make him pay, yes, but I would act only with the greatest care. I must not suffer as a result of taking my revenge. Wrong is not made right in that manner, and also the wrong would not be made right unless Fortunato knew that he was paying and knew he was forcing him to pay. Fortunato was a strong man, a man to be feared, but he had one great weakness. He liked to drink good wine, and indeed he drank much of it. So he knew a lot about fine wines and proudly believed that he was a trained judge of them. I, too, knew old wines well, and I bought the best that I could find. And wine, I thought? Well, wine would give me my revenge. It was almost dark one evening in the spring when I met Fortunato in the street alone. He spoke to me more warmly than was usual. He had already drunk more wine than was good for him. I acted pleased to see him, and I shook his hand as if he had been my closest friends. Fortunato, how are you? Montresor, good evening, my friends. My dear Fortunato, I am indeed glad that I have met you. I was just thinking of you, for I have been tasting my new wine. I have bought a full cask of a fine wine, which they tell me is Amontillado. But Amontillado? Quite impossible. I know. It does not seem possible. As I could not find you, I was just going to talk to Lucrezi. If anyone understands wines, it is Lucrezi. He will tell me, Lucrezi? He does not know one nine from another. And they say he knows as much about wines as you know. Come, let us go. Go where? To your vaults. To taste the wine. No, my friend, no. I can see that you are not well. And the vaults are cold and wet. I do not care. Let us go. I'm well enough. The cold is nothing. Amontillado, someone is playing games with you. And Lucrezi, ha! Lucrezi knows nothing about wines, nothing at all. As he spoke, Fortunato took my arm and I allowed him to hurry me to my great stone palace, where my family, the Montessoris, had lived for centuries. There was no one at home. I had told the servants that they must not leave the palace, as I would not return until the following morning and they must care for the place. This, I knew, was enough to make it certain that they would all leave as soon as my back was turned. I took down from their places on the wall two brightly burning lights. I gave one of these to Fortunato and led him through a wide doorway. There we could see the stone steps going down into the darkness. Asking him to be careful as he followed, I went down before him, down under the ground, deep under the old walls of my palace. We came finally to the bottom of the steps and stood there a moment together. The earth which formed the floor was cold and hard. We were entering the last resting place of the dead of the Montresor family. Here too we kept our finest wines, here in the cool, dark, still air under the ground. Fortunato's step was not sure because of the wine he had been drinking. He looked uncertainly around him, trying to see through the thick darkness which pushed in around us. Here our brightly burning lights seemed weak and dim, but our eyes soon became used to the darkness. We could see the bones of the dead lying in large piles upon the walls. The stones of the walls were wet and cold, from the long rows of bottoms which were lying on the floor. Among the bones, I chose one which contained a very good wine. Since I did not have anything to open the bottle with, I struck the stone wall with it and broke off the small ends. I offered the bottle to Fortunato. Here, Fortunato, drink some of this fine Medoc. It will help to keep us warm. Drink? Thank you, my friend. I drink to the dead who lies sleeping around us. And I, Fortunato, I drink to your long life. Ah, very fine wine indeed, but the Amontillado? It is farther on, come. We walked on for some time. We were now under the river's bed, and water fell in drops upon us from above. Deeper into the ground we went, still past still more bones. The vaults are many and large. There seems to be no end to them. You are a great family and an old one. It is not far now, but I can see you trembling with the cold. Come, let us go back before it is too late. It is nothing. Let us go on. But first, another drink of your Medoc. I took up from among the bones another bottle. It was another wine of a fine quality, like Nicaragua. Again, I broke off the neck of the bottle. Fortunato took it and drank it all without stopping for a breath. He laughed and threw the empty bottle over his shoulder. We went on deeper and deeper into the earth. Finally, we arrived at a vault in which the air was so old and heavy that our lights almost died. Against three of the walls, there were piles of bones higher than our heads. From the fourth wall, someone had pulled down all the bones, and they were spread all around us on the ground. In the middle of the wall, there was an opening into another vault, if I can call it that, a little room about 3 feet wide, 6 or 7 feet high, and perhaps 4 feet deep. It was hardly more than a hole in the wall. Go on, I said. Go in. The Amontillado is in there. Fortunato continued to go forward uncertainly. I followed him immediately. Soon, of course, he reached the back wall. He stood there a moment, facing the wall, surprised and wondering. In that wall were two heavy iron rings. A short chain was hanging from one of these and a lock from the other. Before Fortunato could guess what was happening, I closed the lock and chained him tightly to the wall. I stepped back. Fortunato, I said, put your hand against the wall. You must feel how the water runs over it. Once more I ask you, please, will you not go back? No? If not, then I must leave. But first I must do anything, everything I can for you. But the Amontillado? Yes, indeed, the Amontillado. As I spoke these words, I began to search among the bones. Throwing them down to one side, I found the stones that earlier I had taken down from the wall. Quickly, I began to build the wall again, covering the hole where Fortunato stood trembling. Montresor, what are you doing? I continued working. I could hear him pulling at the chain, shaking it wildly. Only a few stones remained to put in their place. Montresor, this is a very good joke indeed. Many times we will laugh about it, as we drink our wine together. Of course, as we drink the Amontillado. But is it not late? Should we not be going back? They will be expecting us. Let us go. Yes, let us go. As I said this, I lifted the last stone from the ground. Montresor, for the love of God. Yes, for the love of God. I heard no answer. Fortunato, I cried. Fortunato, I heard only a soft, low sound, a half cry of fear. My heart grew sick. It must have been the cold. I hurried to force the last stone into its position, and I put the old bones again in a pile against the wall. For a half century now, no human hand has touched me. May he rest in peace. U.S. Centers for Disease Control's top tip for fending off the flu, coronavirus, and colds is to wash your hands. To protect yourself, you should wash your hands often with soap and water for at least 20 seconds, especially after going to the bathroom, before eating, and after blowing your nose, coughing, or sneezing. The CDC also advises avoiding touching your eyes, nose, and mouth unless you've just washed your hands, covering any cough or sneeze you have with a tissue, then throwing the tissue in the trash, avoiding close contact with people who are sick, and finally, if you do get sick, staying home so you don't infect others. A public health message from WFO in Medford, Tufts Community Radio. All right, so for last 40 minutes, for the music we had, the intro was John by Bedwetter, followed by a quick one before The Eternal Worm Devours Connecticut by Have a Nice Life. The Eternal Worm has had prior exploits prior to coming to Medford, and that was a story about one of the chroniclers of mass death, the kind in which we find ourselves right now, and the kind that the Eternal Worm has unleashed in the past. Then that was To Carry the Seeds of Death Within Me by The Body, accompanied by the ending stanza of H.P. Lovecraft's Nyarlathotep. Then we had The Drop by Hax and Cloak, accompanied by Memory by H.P. Lovecraft. And then we had Feedbacker Part 1 by Boris, accompanied by The Cask of Amontillado by the one and only Edgar Allan Poe. And I've been reading a lot about creepy crawly creatures like the Eternal Worm, and I'm a bit tired from reading. So that's it for the reading tonight, and we're going to listen to some calmer music. This one is from a master of ambient music, Grouper. It's called Alien Observer. Thank you. This is a cover of one of the greatest theme songs of all time.
Let yourself
right, so that was Alien Observer by Grouper, followed by Falling, cover of the Twin Peaks theme by Shoo Shoo, and this is Freezer Burn / I Want to Be Your Dog by Sonic Youth. This is DJ Sam, signing off for the night on 91.5 FM, WMFO Medford, Tufts Freeform Radio. And remember, you can protect yourself from coronavirus, but you cannot protect yourself from the eternal worm. Good night.
favorite smile. Did she change your whole world when you saw her smile? Did you see her smile?
This is Brian Kernahan, and you are listening to WMFO in Medford, 91.5 FM, Tufts Educational Radio.
Just exactly who you are.